I'm Gina Kaufman. With me in the studio now are April Watson, a curator at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, and Edward Matheny, who works as a dramaturg for the Kansas City Repertory Theater. Hi, April.
Hi.
Hello, Edward.
Hello.
Right now, both of your arts organizations are mounting productions related to the soldiers' experience of combat, looking for through lines in different times and places. I wonder what got each of you thinking about this. April, what inspired you to create the American Soldier exhibit at the Nelson?
Well, I've been thinking about this show actually for about 4 years, and it started off really by some contemporary works by contemporary artists that we had acquired for the museum, a work by Suzanne Opton and Richard Moss. And both of them were focusing on American soldiers, which I thought was interesting for a contemporary artist to be looking at that as a subject matter. It's not what you might think.
And those two photographs, at least the two I remember by those photographers in this exhibit, are really, really breathtaking, especially Suzanne Opton's. That's the photograph we described earlier in the show with the young man who's lying face down.
Right.
With this very sort of delicate heart-shaped mouth, and his eyes are kind of in soft focus looking at the ground. He's got this very porcelain
yes.
skin.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a large scale piece, so it's much larger than life. And he's sort of lying down, almost like if you think of Brancusi's sculptures of heads, he kind of is in that mode. And that's a very unusual, just visually, a way to make a portrait of somebody. And he's shown kind of in a very introspective moment, and he's sort of lost in thought. I think one could read a variety of interpretations about what he might be thinking, which I think is the power of the image. There's a sense of intensity, of sort of sadness as well.
This is not a powerful position that he's in either. He's
right.
laying down, face down, and really still.
Very still, yes, very still. And so it's atypical, I think, of, at least in my mind, of images of what we maybe think of, even from the history of photography, of sort of iconic images, if you think back to World War II, of soldiers in the battlefield.
Were you seeing kind of a general difference in how today's photographers, and particularly photographers of American conflict abroad, are portraying war in terms of looking back at the history of war photography? Something new is happening?
Well, I think the images that I was gravitating to were. This show features artists, also works by photojournalists. Ashley Gilbertson and Tim Hetherington were both embedded over in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the images that I'm showing are perhaps not those standard photojournalist images. They are sort of Gilbertson's piece is a project he did photographing the bedrooms of young men and women who had been killed, the empty bedrooms as their family had kept them, soldiers that were killed or else otherwise maybe even committed suicide. The one we have in the show shows a young man who had been killed. So these are personal projects that are maybe different from the typical images that you would maybe see in the mass media.
Let's turn short for a little while to Edward Matheny. Edward, an Iliad is a contemporary interpretation of Homer's Iliad. Is that right?
That's correct. It's a modern reimagining of that epic poem.
What is it about this ancient Greek epic that demands revisiting and strikes you as relevant today?
Through the millennia since the Trojan War, which occurred around, we think, 1200 BC, the technology of war has changed drastically, but the psychology of war has not. And the genius of Homer, whoever Homer was, in terms of describing the psychological effects of combat on the soldiers who are experiencing it, was remarkably ahead of its time. He lays out in ways that modern psychology 3,000 years later is just now catching up with about a phenomenon known as combat trauma. And this is a field that in modern times we started learning a lot more about through counselors working with Vietnam War veterans. And there was a psychiatrist working in the Boston area with Vietnam vets who discovered a certain pattern of events in the war experiences of soldiers who were experiencing chronic PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder on their return from battle. And through some serendipity, he just happened to be reading Homer's Iliad at the same time, and he discovered that in Homer's poem, he lays out precisely the same order of events that lead to this kind of debilitating combat trauma that he was seeing in so many of the people that he was counseling.
So does the hero of the Iliad, Achilles, does he display symptoms of PTSD in the play?
Yes. There's a somewhat simple four-stage series of events that can lead to this kind of condition. The first involves the betrayal of the rank-and-file soldier by military commanders who engage in unwise, unprincipled, or unfair decisions. That takes place in the Iliad with a quarrel between Achilles and his commander-in-chief, Agamemnon. The second stage involves coping with this betrayal through a loss of one's emotional attachment to the army as a whole and one's circle of caring about people being reduced to one's immediate comrades in arms. And this occurs with Achilles withdrawing from the Trojan War to his own unit. Things can become considerably more difficult if among this close circle of comrade in arms, one's closest friend is killed in combat. And this occurs with Achilles, with the death of Patroclus, who is his closest comrade in arms. And then in certain cases following this sequence of events, the soldier's rage and bitterness over events can turn into it becomes transformed into a behavior that in technical terms is called battle frenzy, or a phrase that is typically used is going berserk, which involves a certain form of battlefield behavior that involves recklessness. It's a very unique state of mind that can involve a feeling of being in invulnerability constraints of on behavior in warfare tend to be overcome.
Let's get back to Achilles, though. How
Yes.
does he display that state, that frenzied state you're describing?
In the context of the Iliad, it involves his closest comrade in arms, Patroclus, is killed by the greatest Trojan warrior, Hector. And he, in individual battle with Hector, kills Hector, but this does not satisfy the rage that Achilles has built up. And there, what follows is sort of a loss of social constraints on behavior, and it involves the desecration of Hector's body, because killing Hector is not enough to satisfy the outrage that he feels.
What does the Reps production do with the raw material of Homer's Iliad?
The really engaging thing that the Reps production does with this story is to bring it up to date. And the way the device that they have come up with to do this is to create this character called the poet. Before it was written down, we think, by Homer, the story of the Iliad existed as an oral poetic tradition because at the time the Greeks did not have a written language, did not have a written alphabet. So there was a generation after generation of storytellers or bards who told the story, and the poet is there attempt to imagine what it must be like listening to one of these bards. And this bard is no ordinary flesh and blood storyteller. It appears that he was there at the battle. It appears that he finds himself on a stage throughout the millennia telling the same story for as long as it needs to be told, as long as humankind's propensity to violence leads them into war. As a result, you have some of the play is the actual original language of Homer's epic poem. Half of it is the poet retelling it in more modern terms. And another,
modern as in right now?
Yes, yes. Making modern analogies in modern life to things that were going on back then. And also a series of asides and commentary with the audience as he improvises on this poem as the ancient bards did.
How do you think current events and current perceptions of war shape actors' performances and also audience reactions?
That's an excellent question. I think with the current conflicts going on around the world and the sense of soldiers fighting, their terms being renewed and again, and sort of the fatigue of years and years in the field, this is a conflict. The Trojan War lasted for 10 years. And the events of this play take place during a two-week period in the ninth year of the war. The soldiers have been away from their families for nearly a decade. And after that amount of time, cohesion in the army can break down. And I think that is something that's brought forth very powerfully in this play.
What do you think is the value in trying to understand war and how we relate to it today, not through a civilian lens and not even from the perspective of a combatant in a current struggle, but from the point of view of Achilles, a mythic soldier in ancient Greece?
The choice of Achilles was an artistic choice made back at the time that the original poem was made, because everyone knew who Achilles was. In terms of telling a story about the experience of war, it was someone who was immediately relatable to an audience. The other half of this equation, the play really boils down to two characters. There's Achilles, who is sort of half man, half god, not as relatable as the other character, main character in the play, which is Hector, who is someone that we would recognize more today as a modern citizen soldier.
Well, right, he's mortal.
Right, he's mortal, and he's also the Greeks at the time, they were sort of more of a these were people who did this for a living. The soldiers in the Greek army. The soldiers of the Trojan army were protecting their homeland and protecting a civilization that was under siege, and someone like Hector was fighting literally outside the door to his house inside the city, and he's juggling that with his relationship with his wife and child, and is there for civic purposes rather than fighting as a lifestyle, basically.
I want to jump in on something you said a little while ago having to do with the prolonged absence these soldiers had experienced.
Yes.
From their homes. April Watson of the Nelson, an American Soldier, there is a lot of focus on that absence, on who's being left behind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a group of photographs by Eugene Richards that is from his body of work called War is Personal, and it highlights really the experience, the narrative of a young man who's going back overseas after his first tour of duty, and the really the tormented emotion that his mother and his wife, they have two daughters, experience when he goes away. So I think that's, one aspect, particularly in the contemporary section of the show that I felt was a very strong one, and that one that I thought was important to highlight, especially for folks who, like myself, really are at a remove from the military. I have not served. I don't have family members who have served. But something that I am curious and wonder about are, you know, the effects on the families for soldiers who go off, and then also for when they come back.
You can see in this exhibit, in the course of time represented in the exhibit, how attitudes towards specific wars play mm-hmm. into the photographer's decision about how to represent soldiers. One photograph from World War I shows the men in uniform from above, and they're arranged to make the shape of Woodrow Wilson's head
right.
in profile.
Right.
These troops are definitely honoring their commander-in-chief. But fast forward to a photo taken during Vietnam. Richard Nixon's back is to the camera.
Right.
And his army faces him with hardened expressions. I mean, you see these people, you see the way they're looking at him because of the vantage point. It looks like a standoff.
Right, right. Yes, there's a very conscious decision on the part of the photographer. And one of the soldiers is actually taking a picture of Nixon. So, and that, you know, the Vietnam War is something that I think the meaning in our cultural understanding of that war is still hotly debated today. I think it's something that was very divisive. And at the time that that particular photograph was taken, it was Nixon's first visit to Vietnam as president. So it was after the Tet Offensive, after the My Lai Massacre, after public opinion had really radically changed and anti-war protests had increased. So I think that that photograph sort of reflects that that tension. Also, you know, the whole issue of, you know, what the media and photographers were allowed to photograph is another sort of undercurrent. In Vietnam, actually, there was not so much censorship of photographers. Also, of course, television radically changed the way we understood that war because, as one official said, blood looks very red on television. So I think it was the first time the public was seeing some of the real casualties of war, and they were grappling with that cognitively.
That's so interesting, though, because that could be when we look at these contemporary photographs that really emphasize what people are leaving behind at home or mm-hmm. the experience often in training, mm-hmm. does that have to do with what photographers are allowed to photograph?
Well, it's a bit tricky because I think we're talking about two different kinds of photographs. In the contemporary section, I'm mixing up artists, photojournalists who are working on their own projects, and documentary photographers who are coming from a very personal viewpoint, which is much different from a lot of the photographs in the Vietnam section, which are by Associated Press photographers who were working in a different kind of capacity. So wherever possible in the show, we do try to sort of highlight the fact that there are different contexts that these photographs would have been seen in and understood.
Let's talk about Pool at Uday's Palace by Richard Moss. Describe that photograph for us.
Yes. So that is a large-scale color photograph, and it's on the scale of a painting, which is very deliberate on the part of the photographer. And it shows sort of a rubble-filled swimming pool in a kind of a turquoise blue. And sort of sitting around the edge of that pool are a group of soldiers. And then in the background, you see this sort of sweeping vista of a landscape.
A desert landscape.
Mm-hmm.
An empty, rubble-filled swimming pool at a sort of invaded palace that's crumbling with a desert all around. Like, the swimming pool in the desert is so powerful. And then these guys are sitting around, and you can't quite tell what they're doing. They're in uniform, and they look poised for war in that sense, but they're kind of like, they're just sort of like languishing there in a way, is what it looks like.
Right. I think they're just waiting. You know, they're waiting for their next orders. But I think that's also an aspect of serving in the military, is that those, you know, it's not all frontline battle. There's a lot of waiting. Some boredom along the way. And so I think Richard Moss was kind of highlighting that moment because he himself was embedded with the photographers, and that's what, you know, he wanted to show. And he was also kind of trying to make align that with history paintings of the past, which is another reason he kind of looked out at the landscape and included that with this very contemporary event as well.
Right. A history painting, though, usually would have been an unambiguous sort of
True. Celebration
of a victory. And this is complicated because these troops are depicted in Iraq at a time when President Bush has already made his mission accomplished proclamation. And yet here they are just suspended in this ambiguous situation. Does the uncertainty of their role stand out visually?
Well, you know, everybody's going to bring their own interpretation to it, but I do think that idea of being suspended in time is a great observation. We also have in the show a video piece that accompanies that photograph, and in the video piece is you can hear the sound of music that really highlights also the cultural contrasts between the Americans and the culture that they find themselves suspended in, if you will.
Has the purpose of war photography changed over time? Do you think that that's something you see in this exhibit?
I don't know that I could say that I really made a very strong argument about how the purpose of war photography has changed. Like I say, I tried to emphasize how the different contexts have shaped the way we understand those images. And it's a very that's a very complicated question because, again, it goes back to the degree to which photographers who are photojournalists are allowed access to the front lines. We now have embedded photographers with military.
The tools change.
The tools have absolutely changed, yes. I mean, in the Civil War, they were going out with large format cameras, glass negatives. The technology was too slow to record sort of battlefield action. When you get to World War II, you have the invention of the handheld Leica camera, which allows them to get much closer, much more spontaneous images, much like Robert Capa's image of the troops invading the Normandy coast.
Edward at the Rep, getting back to an Iliad, is there a scene in this play that really gets at some of the issues that have been coming up in this conversation?
Yes. There are several, I would have to say, dramatic climaxes in the course of this play. And there is a point in the play where the poet, because we're talking about how little things have changed in many ways, and the poet starts listing off the all the wars that have occurred since the Trojan War. The reasoning behind this is the this oral poetic tradition that resulted in Homer's Iliad was a feat of memory for the bards involved. It involved the memorization of vast amounts of material and then through a display of virtuosity, listing off things that are like catalogs, lists of events, people, places, things that are important to the story. And in the original material from Homer, there were catalogs that involved things like a list of all the ships that were in the fleet that attacked Troy. And the poet, as part of this improvisational process that these bards went through, realized that he was talking to a modern audience and that this catalog really meant nothing to them. So he starts devising these other catalogs. And one of the other catalogs that he comes up with, and it's a real tour de force for Kyle Hatley, the actor who is the one person on stage in the show, along with a musician who is acting as his muse in this play, begins to recite the names of all these wars up to the present, and it's a remarkably powerful moment in the play as we realize how many times this drama has played itself out.
Edward, we've got to take a short break. Can you stay with me through it?
Yes.
When Central Standard returns, we'll hear more from Edward Matheny of the Rep and April Watson of the Nelson. We'll also bring a veteran in on the conversation. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard. This morning's conversation is all about how the life of the soldier is portrayed in the arts. Right now, two major productions in town deal with the experience of combat. April Watson, curator of the American Soldier exhibit at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, welcome back.
Thanks, Gina.
And Edward Matheny, dramaturg for KC Rep, now showing an Iliad based on Homer's famous epic. Hello again.
Hello.
We've been discussing how artists and actors portray soldiers, but what does someone who's experienced war firsthand think of all of this? For that perspective, please welcome Joseph Burks to the conversation. Hi, Joseph.
Good morning, Gina.
You work at the Kansas City Veterans Hospital, but you're also a veteran yourself. Is that right?
It's true. 21 years, U.S. Army.
Tell us about your experience.
Interesting experiences that I've had over time. In 21 years, I've actually been able to serve in two wars, once in Iraq and once in Afghanistan, at different levels of the military. One front line, out with troops, collecting injured and wounded off the battlefield and trying to get them to a place of better care. All the way through 10 years later in Afghanistan, being at the division level and helping put together the the pieces of puzzle of war and the bigger picture and the policies and the procedures and trying to get a country to stand themselves up to be able to do what it is that we were called there to do in the first place.
When you say collecting wounded soldiers off the field, there's something about that word choice that sounds so like you're picking up this an object. I mean, can you talk a little bit more about what that's like?
Right. The Nelson and what it shows in the soldier, whenever I walked through that on Sunday, was able to see a lot of photos. There are no words with these photos, but a lot of thoughts, a lot of ideas, a lot of pain being shown, a lot of emotion. But the words are missing. And in training, and to go over to Iraq in 2003 and 4, you're set with some goals. And the goal, number one goal, is to bring each and every soldier home alive that's under your care. I had some amazing soldiers, amazing medics, and being in that field, I had to teach them and train them to put away their own personal needs for just a moment and get out there to the injured, to the wounded, and let's get them off of the battlefield. In doing so, we were a small task force of about 700 people, 700 soldiers sent over with a large division, 82nd Airborne Unit. We were sat down in the middle of two very hot zones, Ramadi and Fallujah. With the 700-person task force, 13 months later, out of 700, 149 were wounded in action during that time. That's the story that would want to be portrayed. There were a lot of injuries, a lot of wounds. The story that wasn't shared, of the 149 wounded in action, there was a 0% died of wound rate, which means our medics did it right. If you were injured or you were wounded on that battlefield and you called for help, you got the help you needed, and you got home alive if you were wounded. Now, that doesn't speak on some catastrophic events that we couldn't control. And we lost 20 soldiers during that time. And in losing a soldier, you've lost a friend, you've lost a colleague. We talked about the TV likes to show blood is red. We didn't see red blood. We saw the heart that pumped that blood. And we did everything in our power to get that person to a point that they could be saved. And there were a couple times where we got quite confrontational with doctors in letting us know it was time to get the paperwork ready, time to notify family. And sometimes phones were thrown and said, if you're talking to me, doc, you're not doing everything in your power to save that young soldier. And one of those phone calls, one of those thrown phone conversations ended up with that soldier actually being saved and is a teacher in North Carolina to this day. So seeing the heart that pumps the blood versus the red is what
do you mean by that exactly?
There's a look in an eye that a photo might have taken that we see up close and personal.
So the heart as in like the emotional heart.
The soul of that individual, that soldier. Is there a question, will you say goodbye to my wife? No, you're going to say goodbye. You're going to say hello to your wife when you get home. We're not going to say goodbye. We train with them. We're a part of their life. We're a part of their family. And we know what it is that makes them tick. And it comes to a point where you also understand their time has come on this earth.
When you talk about going through training with these men and these women, in some cases, I'm imagining, in the photographs at the Nelson, there are some that show the training process and really focus on the training process, the transformation of the civilian, often a very young civilian, like really a boy, mm-hmm. the transformation of that person into a warrior. What's your experience of that transformation, that process?
The photo down there at Nelson, titled During Training, the large head of the soldier looking down, long look across some of the ground that he was laying on. What I see, what I shared, what I experienced was there was an exhaust with that young private. I went through it. I knew what it was to lay on the ground and know that I had given everything. I believe what he also wanted to say through that photo, am I doing enough today to make a difference tomorrow and be able to bring that soldier from my left and right home with me? Am I going to put up the fight that's going to protect him? I saw that through that piece. And then there was another piece that grabbed me on a young soldier. The piece was done, the photo by Tim Harrington. I'm sorry.
Tim Hetherington?
Christopher Churchill. Mm-hmm. Exactly. On the Private Greg Melendez.
Yeah.
And we talked about, he was quoted in that photo.
Can I just jump in to
absolutely.
Describe it a little bit?
There's
a young man who's, he's just looking straight ahead. He's standing upright and he's in kind of an, it looks like a very empty room. I mean, he's kind of like there, very isolated, and it's a very straight on portrait. Head to toe, you see this guy in uniform.
And he was isolated. And I think he spent a lot of time isolating himself through some of his training, because some of his comments were I was forced to choke out. And what that means is you're doing some hand-to-hand combat training. And during this training, you are forced to fight, and not only fight, but win. And during some of his training, he actually expressed that as he didn't like it. He had a lot of hate, a lot of anger, a lot of frustration towards the folks who were making him do that. My question back to Greg, which I may never be able to ask him this, but hey, Greg, if you happen to be out there listening at some point, what was your experience moving forward after training? Because if we don't do it there, before we get to combat, and you're expected for the very first time in war to be able to take care of yourself or someone else, Greg, it's going to be a very difficult challenge for you to get home.
What do you think it's important for civilians like me, like a lot of people listening, to understand about the experience of war from the troops' perspective, something they might not understand from the conversation we've already had?
I think family is missing. We see the soldier, we see what they do, we see their heroics, we see some of their pain, with their frustration. Myself, the first time I went to war in Iraq, my youngest daughter, I have two daughters as well, my youngest daughter was 1 year old. And when I left, a child that can barely talk, could barely say daddy, you wondered for 12 to 13 months, what am I coming home to? I'm missing half the life of a young daughter. And I think that our public dialogue and some of our art and some of our photography misses the family portion of this. Every soldier that goes to war, so does a family. And what's their fear? What's their pain? What's their angst? When a phone rings and you're in combat, the phone rings at home, you have a heightened state of awareness. We go through our post-traumatic stress disorders in war. We come home with those unknown, unshown scars. Our family has that as well. And in and over time, I think as we continue to say thank you to that soldier, I want to make it my priority.
Ed, in the Reps and Iliad, the opening scene kind of does get into some of this territory. Can you talk about that and respond to what you're hearing right now?
Yes. There is a point, very much like he was saying, where the poet is... Again, they've been here for 9 years, and he...
Here being Troy at war.
Yes, being on the beach of Troy, engaging in battles outside the walls of the city. And the poet explicitly says, you leave home, your baby is one. You come home, your baby is 10. You leave home, your baby is one. You come home, your baby is dead. All these things that could be going on in the life of your homeland, he says, you come back and you're no longer Greek anymore. The Spartans have taken over and you're Spartan now. Or you've lost title to your lands and your farm is gone. With these long periods of time, there's so much that changes at home and so much of life that the soldier is missing out on.
April Watson, what do you think is the role that the arts can play in public discourse around something like war, something so physical and hard to imagine for someone who hasn't experienced it. The artist isn't a journalist, isn't mm-hmm. necessarily an expert. Mm-hmm. What can the artist bring?
Well, I think helping us to ask the right questions rather than providing easy answers is a very important role that artists can perform. And in a museum, offering a space for contemplation of some very difficult issues that are very complex. And as Joe said, it's like a puzzle. So I think art can do that.
That's all the time we have for today's show. Joseph Birks of the Kansas City VA, thanks so much for being here, and thank you for your service.
Thank you, Gina.
April Watson, curator of American Soldier at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. I really appreciate it. You've been great.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
And Edward Matheny with us from the Kansas City Repertory Theater. Thanks so much. Good luck with your production of An Iliad.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
We will have links to information about the exhibit and the play on our website later today. Tomorrow, we'll talk about how changes in the Catholic Church under the leadership of Pope Francis are affecting followers of the church here in Kansas City. Join us for that tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Intern Daniel Booth collected the reactions to that photograph we saw at 43rd and Main earlier in the show. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's a wrap. Stick around for Up to Date next.